All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Throneberry.
My name is Dale Throneberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio today. We've got, I think, a pretty cool program going. We're going to be talking with representatives from the Military Writers Society to talk about their upcoming conference where you can learn to write a book. And coincidentally, we have our other guest, Jonathan Bernstein, is also a writer. And he is works at the Marine Museum in Quantico. And we're going to be talking about that. And I think it's going to be kind of interesting today. So before I really get into the program, I have to make sure that we thank our sponsors. And that's always important. And we're looking for you out there. If you'd like to become a sponsor of Veterans Radio, all you got to do is go to our website, veteransradio.org, and click on the sponsor button. And we would be more than happy to talk to you about sponsorship opportunities. But we do want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans is a law firm specializing in veterans disability claims. Give them a call at 800-693-4800, or you can go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website. That's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. If you want to do business with the federal government as a veteran-owned business, you got to get certified, and these are the folks that can do it for you. So make sure you do talk to them. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We'd also like to thank our local veterans organizations. These include the Irwin Presscorn American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and who have been sponsors, I think, pretty much from day one. Day one actually was 2003. So we are coming up with an anniversary program on September 30th. September 30th is a Saturday afternoon, and it's going to be Radio on the River Part 2. So we're encouraging you to go to our website, register to come on out. We're going to have guest speakers, including Jonathan Bernstein, Rebecca Grant, and others are going to be there to tell their stories. We're going to have silent auctions. We're going to have food, all kinds of things for you to come out. If you can't come out, you can go to our website, veteransradio.org, and make a donation. We're asking for folks to donate $20 for 20 years. It's hard to believe that we've been doing this for 20 years, a little over 1,000 episodes of Veterans Radio, and we couldn't do it, and we can't do it without your support. So please, go to veteransradio.org, click on the donate button, click on the button on the side that says Radio on the River, and you'll find all the information that is there. We are looking for items for the silent auction. So if you've got anything that you would like to have donate to us, just let me know. You can send an email to me at dale@veteransradio.org. It's dale@veteransradio.org, and we'll take care of that. So check your calendar. If you're in the local Ann Arbor, Southeast Michigan area, September 30th, 3 to 7, the local football team is going to be out of town. So we hope to see you there. All right, getting right into the program right now, we're going to have our first two guests are joining me from the Military Writers Society. And I've first heard about this organization back in 2008. And for those who have been listening to Veterans Radio for so long, you're going to see that we did a lot of stories with many of their authors. And so that's the reason that we have them on. I found out that they have a conference coming up. And so I want to welcome Gary Selinsky and John Cathart from the Military Writers Society to talk about that. So I'm going to go to Gary first, as soon as he unmutes his mic.
Hey,
there we go. Gary, hi.
Dale, thank you. I'm a recently appointed or anointed, and John, my colleague, Cathcart, might correct me. I'm I am a recent member and board member for the Military Writers Society of America. And my current role is to help them in all things communications. And to that end, thank you very much for hosting us. We are about to embark on our annual conference in New London, Connecticut from the 14th to the 17th of September. The first day of that conference, we'll host a Write Your Story event. This is where we will actually be at the Submarine Museum in New London, Connecticut, and we will be offering a course, and I believe they're fairly well attended over the years, about helping the initial writers get a story on paper. And I think that's one of the things that our organization is really good at, and that is helping a would-be writer become more successful. Our crowning achievement in the organization is our book review and award program, of which over the years it's grown quite a bit. And right now we are in the process at the banquet of awarding gold, silver, and medal. Gold, silver, and bronze medals to our finalists. And this has been a banner year for us in our book review program. We've had almost 70 volunteers reviewing books and to a total of like 351 reviews of those books. And this has been very helpful for authors going forward and promoting their books. What we also do is things like Write Your Story events, where we take new authors or new writers and help them become authors, help them get published. We have a number of venues to help them get their stories published. And that's what we're all about, is helping veterans and family members of veterans be more successful in their writing careers. We believe that every veteran, every veteran's family has a very unique story to tell, and that's what we're trying to promote in our organization.
So I couldn't agree with you more, Gary. And John Cathcart, you've been with the organization a little bit longer than 3 or 4 days, and so can you tell me a little bit about the history of how did the Military Writers Society get started?
It was started. Thanks for having us on the show, Dale. We appreciate all the work that you've done over the years for MWSA. The organization started about 25 years ago. A fellow by the name of Bill McDonald set it up, and he was Vietnam era as well, helicopter pilot. And he set it up with in mind helping out authors or soldiers, basically, who had a story to tell. And in many ways, it was a way to deal with what we would eventually call PTSD. In other words, using your writing to help tell a story and to help your inner self as well. And it started off kind of as a one-man show. Bill did. He used to review scores of books by himself, put the reviews online. And since that time, we have he has had some health problems that he continues. I guess for a while there, we were wondering if he was going to be with us, but he seems to be recovering pretty well.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, it is. It is. And we've evolved. And whereas we used to write our books were almost exclusively about the military or military subjects, and it could be fiction or nonfiction, we've really expanded to where we even include a couple of years ago, we started doing romance as a genre where you can submit your book and we'll review it, and put you up for an award if it scores high enough. So, we've really expanded, the genres that we look at. And as Gary mentioned, that program is really designed obviously for someone who's already written a book, and our membership now includes authors from authors who are not yet authors, who are considering writing a book and want some information on what's the best way to go, all the way to our writer of the year for 2019 will be someone that most of us have seen at the movies, and that was Dale Dye. He wrote several books, but the movies I'm talking about are Saving. He was the advisor and starred in several movies that we've all heard of, Saving Private Ryan, near the top of the list, certainly Platoon, several others like that. So he is a face that folks will recognize. And obviously Dale has written, I don't know, he's up to 7 or 8 books now, almost every one of which won awards with MWSA. So that's a writer that doesn't need to learn how to be a writer. He's been at it for a while, and we're helping him in other ways. And then we have people who really have hardly started putting pen to paper, and we can help out with that kind of thing. We have several programs. So it runs the gamut from established authors all the way to aspiring authors.
Well, the thing I always liked about going to the conferences for the Military Writers Society of America was the whole gamut of the genres that you wrote about with books. You know, not only were there war story books, but there were stories from the spouses or the families. There were even children's stories that were in there. You know, how to explain, you know, what daddy did or mommy did in the war type of thing. And I just thought that was always a great service to the civilian population, in addition to all of the therapy, I guess you could say, the cathartic things that occur when you actually sit down and write your story. And you go, oh, my goodness. And then you find out, of course, that there are other people out there that you know, had similar experiences, not only with their time in the service, but especially with their time after their service. And I just met so many great, not only great writers, but just great people. And some of them, you know, they actually helped me, because, you know, they've forced me to kind of look inside of, you know, whatever my adventure had been. And I thought it was very helpful. So I wanted to make sure that we talk about the upcoming conference. It's in New London, Connecticut, and it's over the weekend. Actually, when it starts on the 15th, or it starts earlier than that?
Well, the Write Your Story event at the Submarine Museum starts on the 14th, and that'll go on during the day with a day-long course on taking beginning writers through getting your story ready for publication. And that'll really be the preamble to our conference, and our conference starts on that Friday after that. And we'll have the obligatory business meeting, which I'm going to try and sleep through. And then we're going to go into a series of writers education events, everything from dialogue to the business of writing, things like how best to market your book, how to find a publisher, things like that. So we try to run the gambit of what writers would want to know if they want to go from a story that they share with their friends to something that's published and then ultimately offered as a book, okay, or a screenplay, or things, you know, anything of that venture. We're trying to help them be successful, to include reaching out to audiences where their book would get published. So,
is there? I know that you have on your website a list of books that people can purchase that are available. Is that correct? Is that still on there? John?
Yes, it is. The website, by the way, we have to put in the obligatory plug, if that's all right.
Yes, you do.
We're at
yes.
MWSADispatches.com. So MWSA, like Military Writers Society of America, and then dispatches, because MWSA.com wasn't available. Someone else took that from us. So MWSADispatches.com. And you can look for the details, including a detailed agenda, is in our news and events section. So you can find out exactly what's going on, see what hotel we're staying at, that sort of thing. Find out about membership. And then for each one of our annual book award seasons, you can go in and look at, for example, this year, we had 117 books submitted, and we'll be presenting awards to 62 of those books. And so for all, not just the award winners, but for all the books, you'll be able to go and learn a little bit about the book on our website. And then when you click on the book cover on our website, it'll take you almost always to Amazon, where you can buy either an ebook or a paper copy of the book in question.
Well, I think it's a great program, and it's a great service of what you do at the Military Writers Society. And I encourage people to go to their website, the MSW. Military Writers Society of America, MSWADispatches.com, for more information, because the magazines are all there, and you can read through them. And it's great information for anybody that, you know, has aspirations of becoming an author, or even just to an opportunity to find some books that are from, you know, a little bit lesser known authors, but the stories are just as good and just as well written as some of the bigger ones that you might see, you know, on the recommended list of various places. So I want to thank Gary Zielinski and John Cathcart. Is that right? I'm mispronouncing it. I know it.
You got it.
Okay. I got all the letters in there from the Military Writers Society. Thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio today. And I'm looking forward to seeing the list of the winners so we can start doing some programming later in the year and into next year. So as soon as we get the books that are all, find out what those titles are.
Thanks for having us, Dale.
All right. Thank you both very much. Thank you. So again, that's Military Writers Society of America. Go to their website, mswadispatches.com, to find out more information. It's a really, really great organization. They hold workshops in various parts of the country, all the events that are out there. And not, you know, many of their authors are military veterans, but many of them are not. And that's even neat. I like that. I think they do a great job. All right. We're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, we're going to have our guest for the second half of the program, and that is John Bernstein, and he is one of the curators at the Marine Museum. And there's a whole background to this guy. So make sure you stick around for that. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private Dale Hansen killed 12 Japanese soldiers in a one-man attack on their positions. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Hansen unhesitatingly took the initiative during a critical stage of the action, and armed with a rocket launcher, crawled to an exposed position where he attacked and destroyed a strategically located hostile pillbox. With his weapon subsequently destroyed by enemy fire, he seized a rifle and continued his one-man assault. Reaching the crest of a ridge, he opened fire on 6 Japanese and killed 4 before his rifle jammed. Attacked by the 2 remaining Japanese, he beat them off with the butt of his rifle and then climbed back to cover. Returning with another weapon and supply of grenades, he fearlessly advanced and destroyed a strong mortar position and annihilated 8 more of the enemy.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and our Medal of Honor segment that you just heard, of course, was sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans, but it was also about a Marine. And the reason that I chose that particular episode was to introduce our guest for the rest of today's program. His name is John Bernstein. John is the Arms and Armor Curator at the National Museum of the Marine Corps. But I'm going to introduce him first so we get a little background on him, because he's not really a Marine.
No, not at all.
Who knew? So, John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me, Dale. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. The other thing I want to make our audience aware of is that John is going to be one of our guests at our fundraiser, Radio on the River, on September 30th from 3 until 7 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So for more information, go to the website and click on Radio on the River, and everything is there. So John, let's get a little background on you. Because you were a helicopter pilot like me, a rotor head.
I was.
And how did you get involved in that? Because you said that you were a little bit older.
Yeah, my career has been an odd one. I first got interested in military history at about age 4. My grandfather was an infantry officer in World War II, And when I was about four, he pulled out his Foot Locker for the first time, which became my treasure chest.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, I grew up with his stories. He was my best friend for 32 years of my life. And he's, you know, he made a pretty amazing imprint on me. In 2001, August 2001, I had just been accepted to graduate school at Texas Tech. I'm originally from New York. And so I moved out to Texas in on August 19th of 2001. Of course, 3 weeks later, 9/11 happened. So grad school was an interesting experience. You know, I was 27 at the time, almost 28, and really was I had felt the pull of service throughout my life and had been talked out of it a number of times and finally decided, you know what, I need to do this. I was in grad school for museum studies and then finished the program and went on into a PhD program for military history at Texas Tech as well. But while I was doing that, I was also writing my first book on the Cobra in Vietnam. And I realized while I was doing that, that without military experience in my mind, I wasn't going to be the military historian I could be. I could truly be. And so I started in ROTC in April of 2003. And the rest sort of, you know, went through the program while I was in my PhD program. Most of the people couldn't believe I was doing both, but, you know, I actually ended up leaving the PhD program to go to flight school in November of 2005. And got my wings in July of 07 and flew with the Pennsylvania Guard for my for pretty much my entire time. Ended up with about 600 hours in AH-64Ds and then AH-64As. Never actually went anywhere. I never deployed. But, you know, I whether it's a blessing or a curse, I'm still not really sure. But, you know, I didn't go. The year after I got out, my battalion was deployed and they spent 2013 in Afghanistan. You know, it was,
You know, you signed the paper.
I did.
They just didn't need you at the time.
Yep.
Which is, you know, is annoying. I know for other people I know who are pilots who didn't get to, you know, deploy or go down ranges. Your generation says.
Yep.
But, still, you signed it. You were ready to go. Yeah. Just the idea of flying the Apache, I think would be an awesome experience. I mean, you know, I'm flying, you know, in the Huey a maximum of 120 knots and it's already shaking apart.
Sure.
at that point. And you know, to go as fast as you guys can go and all the other maneuvers that you can make with those amazing Sure. machines.
The funny thing is the Apache really doesn't go all that much faster than that, but it's maneuverability wise, it was a pretty amazing machine. I think the fastest I ever went, I had was 165 knots with a major tailwind. So, you know,
if I tried that, the blade would have flown off.
Sure. Getting the mast bumping and everything there.
What are you doing? You know, we've been talking back, but you know, and of course the idea of the firepower that you have and the, you know, and the screens and everything else, much more, obviously much more complicated than, you know, flying the Model A and Model T's of helicopters.
Sure.
I just think it would have been a great adventure. So when you got out, you finished up your PhD or you finished that while you were in the Guard?
Actually, I still have not finished it. I'm looking to eventually get back to it, but, the career sort of took precedence. While I was in the Guard, I was working as the director of the National Guard Educational Foundation. That's actually, you know, I spent 3 years there. And then I got a job out at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as the director of the Air Defense Artillery Museum. And I was out there for about 8.5 years as the director. Had a blast there as an Army civilian. I really kind of miss it. But it was a great experience. And I actually got to build a museum from the ground up. Which was pretty remarkable. It's not an opportunity most curators get to do.
No, and I think being a museum curator, I think that sounds like a fun job.
Yeah,
I mean, really. I mean, I've been to a, you know, obviously a couple of military museums, And so you worked there, I'm sorry, for how long?
At my current job, I've been here for 3 years, but prior to that, I was out at Fort Sill for about 8.5 from 2012 to 2020.
Okay. And then that's what I meant earlier on, that you made the transition from the Army to the Marines.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely been a shift in culture. There's a lot of overlap, but there are certainly things, I think I said earlier, that there are things that the Marines are really, really strict about that the Army isn't, and vice versa. And it's sort of been interesting getting used to learning that. Like if you called an E6 in the Marines sergeant, you'd get chewed out. If you called an E6 in the Army sergeant, he'd say what? So it's, you know, he would be staff sergeant in the Marine Corps. And it took me a little bit to get used to that. But it's really been quite cool now that I'm used to it.
Well, I think what's so interesting about the museums themselves is, you know, to tell the story of the Marines, and what, you know, and what their mission is. And, we got a phone call. Oh, it's another Apache pilot. joining us on the line right now is, Kate Melcher, who's better known in local areas as the representative for Fisher House, Michigan. So, Kate, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for sneaking me on, Dale. I couldn't help but call in when one of my fellow unit members was on the show.
Hey, Kate, how you doing?
It's great to hear from you, John. Congratulations for your latest book and for joining us here on Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for making me aware of this. This is really fantastic.
Well, I wanted to mention, and, you know, Dale, I'm sure you'll get to it, but I had to call in and brag on John a little bit because he talked a lot about, you know, while his military service didn't include a deployment, one of the things that he was part of the larger team on when he was at the National Guard Museum was that was the era when the National Guardsmen and reservists were deploying at operational tempos that none of us had ever planned. They weren't trained, they weren't equipped, even manning was an issue. And so it was really important for the National Guard to have a seat at the table when the decisions were made about which units were going where and how they were going to be trained and equipped. And so there was a huge team of folks between the National Guard Bureau and Legislative Liaison and at NAUGUS, the National Guard Association of the United States, and John's role in educating all of the different players, there was a movement to get the chief of the National Guard Bureau a fourth star. And history tells us that we were all successful, and the chief does have a fourth star and is a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I wanted everybody that's listening to the show to know that John was a part of that.
Just a little part, but yeah, it was very cool.
See, this is what you learn all about here on Veterans Radio. You never know what you're going to hear.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. Congratulations on that, John. I'm also supposed to, I got a little note that says, supposed to wish you a happy birthday.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I just turned 50 yesterday. So,
just a child.
Starting my sixth decade and, you know, was daunting in the lead up, but I think I'm pretty comfortable with it now.
Yeah. It's all right. 50s were good. Yeah. 50s were good. Speaking from experience many years ago, it seems like. Thank you very much, Kate, for calling. And for those of you that are not familiar with Kate, is the executive director of Fisher House, Michigan. Her ultimate goal is, I guess you're going to build another house in Detroit, and you were up in the UP looking up there now?
That's right. So we're building Detroit presently, and VA Iron Mountain is actually interested in applying for a Fisher House. So we may have Fisher Houses in both peninsulas of Michigan. But thanks for letting me, butt in a little bit here, Dale. I think I get special preference because I have the honor of serving on the board of directors for Veterans Radio. So proud to serve in that role, too, in addition to my Fisher House duties.
Thank you very much, Kate.
All right. Take care. See you soon, John.
Take care, Kate.
All right. Yes, she is, yes, we are privileged to have her and many other really great board members on Veterans Radio Board of Directors. So getting back to the transition, as you mentioned, from the Army to the Marines, tell me a little bit about this museum and the design of it and so forth.
The National Museum of the Marine Corps opened in 2006, November 10th, 2006, for the birthday of the Marine Corps. And it has been sort of evolving ever since. There were a couple of different phases of exhibits opened. We're actually now working on our final phase, which is Gallery 13 and 14, which covers from post-Vietnam up through 2015. Those galleries were supposed to open originally in 2019, but due to the hurricane that hit Camp Lejeune in 2018 and then COVID hitting, things sort of were delayed. So we're back on track now, and things are looking absolutely outstanding for the eventual opening. I'm not sure exactly when that's going to be yet. I don't have the specifics on it, but I can tell you that the new galleries look absolutely fantastic.
I was looking at the website for the museum, for the National Museum of Marine Corps, and the design of the museum itself is really cool. I mean, we're all familiar. And I guess for any of those Marines that are out there that you'd like to talk to John about your museum, you can give us a call here at 734-822-1600. This is your opportunity to talk about being a Marine. I know it's different, but feel free to do that. But the design of this, the museum, we're all familiar with the raising the flag at Iwo Jima.
Yes.
And we're not on television, but I'm looking at the design of the, it looks like the main building, I'm assuming.
Yes, it is.
And you can, it's the flag.
It is designed to invoke that feeling. It is the flag raising at Iwo Jima. Yeah, it is a remarkable design. It's right off I-95 at exit 150 south of DC. And you can't miss it. It's this great big spire rising up through the trees, and it looks magnificent.
So what makes the Marine Corps Museum any different than the other branches of the service?
It's the first, national branch museum that really focuses on the stories of individual Marines. It's not just here's a bunch of stuff. It's, you know, here's Lance Corporal John Pomeransky's rifle that he brought home. Here's Smedley Butler's Mameluke sword. Each piece we have in the collection tells a Marine's story, and that's one of the things we're most proud about. With the museum's collection, because when it comes down to it, the strength of the Marine Corps are the individual Marines themselves.
Yeah, that's true. I was looking under the mission of the Marines and so forth. You know, it's that when I wrote that question, it says, you know, the Marines are normally the first to fight. They're sure. Usually, in most cases, they're sent in first. This is, you know, way before all the aviation that's mm-hmm. out there, first on the ground, let's put it that way.
Sure.
Other than, you know, the special forces guys that are always sneaking around out there, right, doing stuff. they take pride that their training is more intense than the other branches.
Sure.
In most cases. And of course, their history.
Absolutely. It's interesting looking at the comparison between soldiers knowing their history and Marines knowing their history. And, you know, the Army does a really good job now of teaching history. Actually, when I was an Army Museum director, I was involved in working up the lesson plans and the curriculum for training soldiers. And that's what the Army Museum Enterprise became, a soldier training entity. The Marines have been getting that for forever, really. Since it's part of their training to learn their history and learn that they're part of something bigger. And it's outstanding to be a part of that now. I really love that aspect of it. Every Marine knows their history, knows their campaigns, and it's a beautiful thing.
Okay, that would be good. That would be good. We didn't learn. Well, I'm trying to remember back. It seems so long ago now. Our indoctrination into the Army, and it talks a lot about World War II and World War I.
Sure,
if I remember right, and Not that much. So in the museum, which the museum is all part of kind of the Marines Foundation.
So the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation is co-located at the museum, and they are the museum support organization, and they are amazing. They publicize us, they fundraise for us, they do all sorts of stuff for the museum. And, I working with the foundation, I actually just shot a video for the town hall, with Major General Lukeman, 2 weeks ago or something like that, which is going to air on September 14th on their website. Just a great organization to work with, and their support, has been invaluable to the museum.
Well, I'm sure that it involves a lot of fundraising.
Quite a bit. Yes. Yes.
Tell us about some of the exhibits that are there. I'm kind of curious about that. I mean, do we go all the way back to the Barbary Coast? And
we do, actually. We have an early years gallery, which starts in 1775, actually pre-1775. We do have a number of really great artifacts from the Barbary Coast and from, say, the War of 1812. Really early Marine stuff. That is just incredible. Of course, that gallery then works around into the Civil War. And then, the next gallery deals with sort of the beginnings of the expeditionary fighting force, dealing with, soldiers at, or I shouldn't say soldiers at sea. The Marines at sea, aboard ship really are the first expeditionary, military force for the United States. They're the ones who are, like, in 1871, McLean Tilton led an expedition, a punitive expedition into Korea since the Korean nationals were firing on American commerce ships. And they were trying to open up Korea for trade. And there was a major expedition in battle. Really, in 1870, where we attacked a number of, or I shouldn't say, we counterattacked against a number of installations along the Korean coast, and we actually have a cannon, an 1871 culverin that was captured there, and that's in the collection.
That certainly is a piece of information that we didn't know that we were involved in Korea that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we moved on from there. And then I'm not very good at my history here, but so we move along into the Spanish American War.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure there's something between that time period, but
yeah, I mean, but that was all that gallery deals with pretty much the beginnings of real expeditionary, empire building, and then on into the Spanish American War, and even into a little bit of the sort of what we call the Banana Wars, which started in at the turn of the 20th century, but really didn't kick off until the interwar period. But still, we're sort of the entry into that was really in the pre World War I period. After that, we have our World War I gallery, which, of course, deals with the Marine involvement. We have a phenomenal experience exhibit where it's like you're immersed into the Battle of Belleau Wood, where there are explosions going off around you, and you get puffs of air, that hit you as you're experiencing this. And there's a video playing at the same time, which is pretty much the Marines charging across the open field at the Maxim machine guns that the Germans were firing at. And it's just an incredible exhibit.
That sounds like the confidence courses.
It's pretty intense. It's a remarkable exhibit. Very, very cool to see.
I know that you have an exhibit there, about Sergeant Reckless.
Yeah, we do.
For those of you familiar here of Veterans Radio, remember we did a whole episode on Sergeant Reckless and other animals in the war, sure, during war, and this amazing horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, promoted a number of times. So, yeah, very cool.
So how do they do that one?
Actually, that's not really my my lane. We have actually five different curators. We have uniforms and heraldry, art, aviation, and then sort of material, cultural material history, and then I'm arms and armor. So I pretty much only deal with weapon systems other than aircraft. So
kind of unusual, considering that most of your books are about aviation.
Yeah, you know, my heart's in aviation. One of the cool things I do get to do is aviation ordnance falls under me, so I deal with pretty much any anything that's dropped or fired from an aircraft. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, we have an outstanding aviation curator, Dr. Larry Burke. He came to us from the Smithsonian a couple years ago, and he's been just a pleasure to work with. And he and I are actually co-curating an exhibit that eventually may happen. But we discovered the last surviving unmodified AH-1G Cobra that flew in Vietnam with the Marines. There are only six surviving G model Cobras left, that were unmodified. And this is the only one that flew with the Marines. So it was a really pretty amazing find we had a couple years ago. And Larry and I are working that one jointly over the next, I'm not sure how long, but it is a one we plan on getting on exhibit eventually.
I think that'd be cool. So no, do you already have the aircraft?
We do.
There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, it was pretty incredible.
I think that's so. When you're talking about ammo and armor, you're talking about exhibits of flintlocks up to laser controlled.
Exactly.
Weapons.
Yep. Yep. So I mean, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, flintlocks to Hellfires to you name it. Tanks, vehicles, all that stuff falls under me. So it's been, my expertise is more along the lines. I mean, obviously aviation, but also I have a fairly extensive background in vehicle curation. And, that's really one of the things I love to do. It's been a lot of fun, working on vehicles, getting them restored, getting in some cases, getting them running again, not here at the Marine Corps Museum, but, in the past we had a running M16 half track at the Air Defense Artillery Museum that we used as a mobile classroom, which was pretty cool.
I would think so. So what would you say has been the what's the biggest vehicle that you've been working on, or biggest form of armor that you're working on there now?
Right now, So we lost some of our storage a couple of years ago, just before I got there. And so we moved a significant chunk of our macro artifact collection, so all our vehicles, artillery pieces and stuff like that, out to the Pima Air and Space Museum out in Arizona. And we have a great working relationship with the guys out there. Scott Marchand, their director, has been just phenomenal. And I went out there for the first time since I came aboard here. Back in June, and I took a look at our Sherman tank that's out there. And, I actually had a major, major discovery, when I climbed up on it. Now it was a modified, standard M4A3 that had a flamethrower added to it in the late summer of 1945, in preparation for the invasion of Japan. So it was converted in Hawaii on Maui, with the POA CWS H5 flamethrower system, which is Pacific Ocean Area Chemical Warfare Service H5, was the standard for that flamethrower. And so it was pretty rare. There's only two H5 flame tanks, that were modified there, in existence. But I climbed up on it and I realized very quickly that it had weld scars all over the top of the turret. And there was a pattern to them. And it wasn't just, you know, some stuff stuck on the turret. It was evidence that it had nails, 3-inch nails welded to the roof. Now there's only one tank battalion in the Marine Corps, that did that modification in order to keep magnetic mines from sticking flush to the roof of their tanks. And that was the 5th Tank Battalion on Iwo Jima. So as I started looking into this tank more, I realized, okay, it has these weld scars all over the top of the turret. Does it have them on the driver's hatches? And it did not. So I was able to rule out pretty quick that it wasn't an A Company tank, but it was still 5th Tank Battalion. And from the weld points that were there, I was able to determine that it is actually a C Company 5th Tank Battalion tank. And I could get into more because there's a lot more detail to it, but I'm actually going to be presenting this as a paper to the Society for Military History in this coming April. So I don't want to reveal too much, but yeah, this has been a major project that I've been dealing with, and it's just been absolutely spectacular and just so much fun to work on. So
I would think so. It sounds like just a great job to have because, you know, this is, quote, American ingenuity at work. I mean, obviously absolutely. It didn't come from the factory where these nails welded
right.
to it to, deflect the, I didn't even know the mortars would, you know, attached to a tank. I never even thought about that.
Sure. Yeah, they actually, there were all sorts of defenses the Marines created to keep these basically magnetic mines about five, six inches in diameter. And a single one could blow through about 3/4 inch of steel if it contacted and stuck flush with the armor. So if it would do it on the top of the turret, that armor is only 1 inch thick at its thickest. And on the hatches and stuff, it's really only about 3/4 inch. So if you could stop it from landing flat just by hitting the nails, or which would either prevent it, you know, make it hit on an angle, or they would space it off enough that the explosion would be mitigated enough that it wouldn't damage the tank. So really pretty ingenious.
I love the way these men and women think of ways to protect themselves. You know, it sort of reminds me of the beginning of the, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan with the
yes.
Humvees where they were, you know, they were getting people to ship them pieces of Kevlar and so forth to
sure.
utilize as protection.
Sure. Also the hillbilly armor. Yeah.
Hillbilly armor.
I
like that. You know, they used to say on the Huey, you used to use baling wire and string to hold it together sometimes.
Sure.
or spit on it to make sure that it would work. So the tank is that the largest vehicle that you were working with or is in your museum?
Right now, I mean, it's actually, you know, it's still out in Arizona. The stuff that's in the museum is pretty much, is pretty much installed. We just installed some, the 50 cal and the grenade launcher in our, AAV-7, our amphibious assault vehicle. We have, we've got LAV-25 and of course we have our M60A1 patent tank, which was the first to cross the berm into Iraq in 1991. And that one is part of the new Gallery 13, which was pretty amazing to see that one go in.
I would think like a great war movie.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the museum. Does it cost anything for me to go
if I want to get over there? It is free and open to the public. We're open 9 to 5, 364 days a year. And so we're closed Christmas. But other than that, yeah, I mean, it is a fantastic place and it's absolutely free to visit.
Sounds like an awful lot of interactive activities that you've got going there too. I understand that there's a firing range.
There is actually, it is pretty neat to see. It's one of the laser, engagement trainers that teaches rifle marksmanship. And, it's a pretty cool thing. So actually I failed to mention my favorite exhibit, which is our Vietnam exhibit, because you turn a corner at one point and you walk into the fuselage of a CH-46. And you feel the vibration and you smell the hydraulic fluid and you hear the radio. And then you step down the ramp and a blast of hot air hits you in the face. And suddenly you're at Khe Sanh.
Oh.
And it is one of the most visceral museum exhibit experiences I've ever had. And, you know, as a helicopter guy, as a historian, it was amazing. The first time I was there, I literally just stood inside the fuselage with my eyes closed, listening for a couple minutes before I stepped off. So,
wow, that sounds really cool.
Yeah,
I mean, just the idea that I was at a vet fest recently, and there was a Chinook that came in and landed, and you got to walk back in the back of it, and mm-hmm. so forth. And I can't imagine all the noises and the smells that you say, you know, the hydraulic fluid and everything, the JP4 and everything, all the mixtures of everything that is there. I think that's cool. I really encourage people to go to the Marine Museum. It's what's the particular website they should look at if they want more information?
It's usmcmuseum.com. And yeah, everything you could possibly want is right there. It's a fantastic website.
It's a good journey. And I also encourage people to go look at John's books. I mean, if you're interested in aviation, World War II, all the way up through helicopters and everything else, it seems like you've been writing quite a few of those over the years.
Yeah.
What's the next one that you can talk about?
I haven't really settled on a new book just yet. I've been writing a number of articles for Leatherneck Magazine recently, and so that's really taken up a lot of my time. But I definitely do want to do something. My heart's in tactical air power in World War II, so I'm really looking back at the Ninth Air Force in 1944-45 and sort of how it evolved. Actually, I should say 43 to 45, how it became the tactical air power entity that it was by the end of the war.
So. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Jonathan Bernstein, author, curator, guest at Veterans Radio's Radio on the River coming up on September 30th. Thank you for your time today. I think this is great. Thankfully to you, we are being able to, you know, maintain the history of what's occurred, because without people like yourself, we don't know what happened, and it kind of disappears. Just like we're always talking about telling our stories. You know, if we don't tell the stories, they just kind of disappear into the wisp of the air.
Exactly.
So Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Dale. This was fantastic.
All right. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
All right. That's it for today, Veterans Radio. I want to remind everybody of our upcoming Radio on the River and how you can help out. You can purchase a ticket. You can purchase tickets to donate to veterans to come to Radio on the River. If you can't make it, you can just make a donation to Veterans Radio. We're looking for $20 for 20 years. It's hard to believe that we've been doing this program for 20 years. And I want to thank all of you who have been supporting us in the past and support us in the future. And if you have any stories you want, let us know about that so that we can cover those stories. We're going to have a whole bunch of things coming up. So until next week, this is Dale Thornberry for all of us here at Veterans Radio. You are dismissed. Yeah.